Hi everyone, this is Catherine and welcome to the First Times Summer Series in which we are revisiting some of our most popular and favourite episodes. As you'll already know if you've listened to the Season 6 finale, Kate and I are taking a break from the First Time in its current format in 2024. But don't delete the feed just yet. I will be back in March with something new and slightly different. It'll still feature interviews with writers, but there'll be other creatives, comedians and entrepreneurs involved as well. One last thing before we get into this particular interview. To celebrate 6 seasons of the podcast and to kick off the coach salting work I'm doing for writers this year, I'm posting a series about what I've learned on the podcast, particularly about interviewing and being interviewed these past few years on Instagram. You can check it out at Catherine Collette Writer. I'll put a link in the show notes. This is the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. This interview is with Andy Griffiths. I was very, very excited to talk to Andy. You would be very hard-pressed not to know his work if you have small children in your life. But even if you don't, Andy Griffiths is one of Australia's most popular children's authors. He and illustrator Terry Denton have collaborated on more than 33 best-selling books since their first title, Just Tricking, was published in 1997. Probably, however, you are more familiar with their Treehouse series, which started with the 13-story Treehouse. Andy and Terry's books have sold over 10 million copies in Australia alone, won 80 Children's Choice Awards and 10 Australian Book Industry Awards. In this discussion, Andy and I talk about his approach to writing humour, which is incredibly logical, unusual that you pair those things together. We also talk about how he works with his longtime collaborator, Terry Denton, and how working in schools has been a major contributor to him honing his craft. We hope you enjoy the discussion. Andy Griffiths, welcome to the First Time podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Andy, I didn't include this in the bio, but I did read that you have been writing since you were 6 years old. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. I can remember delighting in picking up a pen, and my dad was sick, so I made him a get well card, and it said, "Dear Dad, get well soon." And then he turned the page and said, "Or you are doomed." Just to make the point, I showed him being buried in the backyard with a little icy pole stick cross and some worms and maggots, and he got better really fast. I knew I had a talent for something, and it was, in this case, it was doing the opposite of what you're supposed to do. You know, when you write a get well card, you're meant to be nice, not threatening. but that kind of comic instinct has been with me ever since then, and I can't get rid of it, actually. I find it very hard to write seriously because this little voice is always, do the opposite.
Well, I love that idea. That's something that we'll come back to because I was about to say it feels like not a lot has changed then. I could see that in a Treehouse book.
Very little has changed, yeah. I've got more control over it these days, I think. But in the early years of writing, I had no control. It was just sort of exploding out, and what I got was what I got, and people would be upset, and you know, or others would be delighted. Some would be upset, but I guess over the last 30 years, I've learned to control that humor a little more.
Well, I want to come back to this idea, but Andy, so. You started writing at 6. You've now written 30-something books. The first one was Just Tricking. How did that come to be in the world?
I guess it came, I found myself as a secondary English teacher in late 80s, and I'd been wanting to write. I'd been in bands, little underground bands in Melbourne as the vocalist, because I was the lyric writer. And that was, that started off, like most of my projects, it started off as a joke, like a joke band, will be the wildest rock and roll band in Melbourne. And so I ended up as the vocalist, and I loved that. And rock and roll and alternative music is very deep and dear to my heart. But I wasn't a great vocalist, and I just thought, you know, it's the writing I love. And so I started taking Learn to Write courses, just basic ones, to help me, because I always had that ability to communicate. But as I was saying, I didn't have much control. So I took Learn to Write courses. I also did a dip ed, found myself in front of lots of kids in year 7 and 8 who hated reading. They'd never had a good experience with a book. Just thought books and libraries were for nerds who had, you know, losers. It was pretty harsh. And it had never occurred to me that you would have a life without books. And but rather than lecture them, what I started doing was write them some of the funny things that I used to write for my school friends when I was in school. Little stories like the day my bum went psycho, the day I was, you know, needed to go to the toilet in a shopping centre and I couldn't find a toilet. So I had to put, I accidentally started a fire and then I had to put it out. And so little things like that. And they went, oh, right, this is funny. Can we do our little stories? And so I said, sure. And so then I started writing with them, and they were writing for each other, and it was really felt organic process. And I collected a number of my stories, self-published them in a little book, and sold it to friends and families and at markets around Melbourne. And so that
original self-publishing, is this like a stapled sort of
photocopied
scenario?
Staples, hand cut. Now that came out of my experience with the alternative bands, because you would do your own things. You'd make your own cassettes, you'd make your own covers, you'd put them in the shops, you'd organise a launch, and, you know. So it was all do it yourself. So that came very naturally to me. And I knew no publisher in their right mind would want to publish what I was publishing at that point anyway. Because it was just crazy. But that gave me absolutely a place to start from. And I got reactions from people. That first one was called Freaking Out. And it was just a collection of 50 very short pieces. So not me, like a dream or a set of instructions, a tiny memory. It was not a narrative in any sense. But it had a lot of language in it, and I couldn't take it into school. So then I rewrote it. I took out the unsuitable pieces and rewrote it to be suitable for secondary schools. And that became the basis of my first book, an educational book called Swinging on the Clothesline, which was for teachers to how to have more fun with creative writing in their classrooms. And I paired it with little exercises, you know. Here's something you can do. Put something in a jar and encourage your students to write labels for the front and the back. So it might be grass, and grass would be instant takeaway food for cows, you know, and you'd write a little story on the back. You hate it when you've been chewing in the paddock all day and you haven't got anything ready for dinner. Well, what you need is grass. And so I gave them little formats, and I knew from experience my own students loved it, because they're writing, but they're not having to construct an entire narrative, which is hard work. So what I learned to do for myself and in this book for teaching was to just break it down into the component parts. So I would just say, write me a monologue of someone that you know well. It could be your friend, it could be your mother, could be, you know, your principal. Just write down what they would normally say, you know. Oh, your room's a mess, clean it up, or you're not going out tonight. Now, I've told you, how many times have I told you? And when I got them just to write that down, they could all do it. And then they could read it out to the class and everyone would you know, respond and go, this is great, you know. Can I read mine next? And so that's what I was doing in that book. And the publisher, Longman Cheshire, 1993, we're talking now, got Terry Denton, a freelance illustrator, to illustrate that book. Now, I didn't know who he was. I knew nothing, but I knew I loved his drawings. And eventually I got to meet him a few years later. And he said, oh, I love drawing what you write, you know, because it lets me go to really wild, crazy places. And I said, well, I love what you're doing. You know, if I could draw, this is what how I would draw. So he helped me get the first book, Just Tricking, published in 1997 by simply agreeing to illustrate it. By this stage, I'd been rejected by most Australian publishers in, you know, quite nicely. Oh, we find your material very entertaining, but we can't see a market for it. I was like, oh, gee, I thought that was the point of writing, with be entertaining.
It's interesting, though, because it had been tested, really, hadn't it, in many ways? The fact that you'd been in schools, you'd talked to kids.
I knew that, but they didn't know that. So I'd done my time at the markets, watching people react to the little books I was making. So I'd done a fair bit of market research, and I knew that at least 20% of the population were very tickled by my style of humour. So that gave me encouragement to just keep going and to keep developing it, because to be fair to those publishers, as I said, I didn't have full control of my own writing, and that came through a lot of work. And I did a graduate diploma of fiction writing and editing. Carmel Bird was one of my teachers, and she was amazing. Very influential and very encouraging, because she refused to tell me how to do it. I'd say, just give me the secret, skip all this stuff, just give me the secret, how do you get published? And she said, you'll find your own way. And annoyingly, but I would go to any writer's talk I could, and I would listen to the writer's talk about how they did it. And it became obvious to me after a few years, everyone has a different way of doing it. Some people keep extensive journals and, you know, plan out their novels. Others just wake up and just write anything that comes into their heads. And I began to realise, oh, yeah, it's whatever works for you, however you can do it. You need to know all the different approaches, but then you figure out what your thing is.
There is no secret in the end, by the sense of it.
No, it's just, you know, knowing that you are writing for someone and that you're trying to do something to them. You're trying to make them feel a particular way. In my case, I'm trying to make my readers laugh, and I'm trying to make them turn that page as fast as they can. So that guides me. And that's what I want to do too. I can fake a literary style if I want, but it doesn't come easily, and it's not me. I did shortlist for the Age Short Story Competition with a story I wrote during those studying years, but it didn't win. And then I thought, look, even if it had won, it wouldn't be particularly satisfying, because it's not what I really, really want to do. I want to get that Mad magazine, punk rock, young ones kind of energy in fiction. That's what I want to do. So at the end of all my study, which was a couple of years, I went, okay, put that aside now, and now just write the same way as you were before you knew all this stuff. And then it surfaced naturally that I knew by that stage how easy it is to mislead a reader by careless phrasing, by too many metaphors or similes, and that readers are easily confused, and particularly kids who are easily bored. So I have to try to lay down each sentence to make sure they're coming with me, and that was really useful to know.
Andy, when you look back at that early work, you've mentioned this idea of control. When you look at the humour itself and the style of humour that was present, say, in Just Tricking versus Treehouse,
Can you see how it's evolved?
Yes. Yeah. Because that was the late 90s. And I was recently watching on ABC, what was that program they had on in the mornings, like Saturday mornings? It was the rock and roll show
hosted by Rage.
Not Rage. I can't remember
Countdown?
The name.
Countdown? No.
No, it was somewhere in between those two. Dylan Lewis was this chaotic.
I remember him. He was very chaotic and very punk kind of vibe.
Fantastic. And what they were getting away, that show was just madness for 3 hours. It was unplanned. It was, well, barely planned. And I think my books reflect that of the time. So Andy in those books is trying to annoy as many people as he can. He's doing every stupid thing that anyone could do. And he's like, yeah, whatever, you know, I'm punk rock. And kids really responded to it because there was nothing else like that at the time in print. And that was my goal, was to say, come on, let's writing books and writing have as much energy as punk rock, as movies. They're as exciting as computer games. And they give you a different, it's a different way of interacting with it. It's a very personal way in which you're collaborating with the writer to create a story between you. So those days, anything went. I recently, Just Tricking was republished in UK just recently on the back of the Treehouse series. Treehouse is much gentler. We did all our crazy experiments through the Just books. We did the bad books where we explored the limits of really absurd, dark humour where everyone's dying and maimed and killed for no particular reason apart from it's funny. And I was public enemy number one at that point, I remember. Proudest moment, getting on Current Affair. Should your children be reading this book, the bad book? And booksellers refusing to have it in their shops and keeping it in the back. You'd have to climb up a ladder to get it from the forbidden box. And
I had read about this, and so aptly named, really. Like,
yeah, I was trying to do a bad book. Would I really call it the bad book? I mean, is there irony there, anyone? But we went to the limits of what was acceptable, even for Australia. And in Australia, we could get away with a lot more than any other country. Back then, I think things have gone slightly more conservative now, to my dismay, because I was trying to push back the boundaries and go, we can write about anything. Now I'm getting off track here. So then by the time we got to Treehouse, we'd done all the outrage. And then I said the most outrageous thing I could do would be to not be outrageous. And I did a series of very sweet novels called the Schooling Around series, Treasure Fever, Pencil of Doom, Mascot Madness, and Robot Riot. And those were very sweet. They were more conventional narratives about a group of kids in a kind of wacky school. They didn't kind of break through in the same way as everything else I'd been doing, although they were loved by a certain section of my readership. And then I thought, you know what, if I was to do that again, I would just add 10% more slapstick, 10% more boundary pushing, and I would have it heavily illustrated, which was the way Terry and I had been going in our collaboration. And so that was the first Treehouse book, was attempting to fix up what I did with Schooling Around and make it more palatable. Now, we didn't know at the time that we got the balance, just how most people like it, 10% slapstick rather than 90% mayhem. And also what the Treehouse did was give the reader a safe place. So the Treehouse itself, although there's a bit of chaos in the branches, is basically home, and the threats often come from outside of that. So, and the friendship between Andy, Terry and Jill, based on the one in real life, is also reassuring to readers, so that you can have big threats. You can have Professor Stupido, the world's greatest uninventor, come in and start uninventing everything. He uninvents the entire universe. You don't get more threatening than that. But in the end, we know that, well, they trick him into uninventing himself, and then Terry draws the whole universe back into existence. So you can have that degree of existential chaos, but come back and you know they're going to be friends. Andy pushed Terry's head into the sun at one point. But you know they're going to be friends in the end.
I think what's really interesting about that idea of uninventing even and inventing is there's a whole lot of logic that sort of, like, even though the premise is absurd, the steps that follow are fairly logical. Is that something that you had to learn as you refined that skill of humour?
Yes. It comes naturally too, but it was something I became conscious of, that if comedy is illogical, if anything can happen, then it stops having tension and stops being particularly funny. We know this every time. There was a short story in the Just collection called Pinch, where it's basically a dream where Andy is sucked into Terry's mouth and he goes through a whole dream-like thing through his head. That was one of the few stories no one ever said, oh, I love that story. People just went, oh, yeah, dream. Off. Whereas the other stories I write could be, they're like dreams, but they have, as you say, a logic to them. So if you have an uninventor who can point at something and uninvent it because it annoys him and they call on him, you've got to help us get rid of this writing machine. It won't let us write our book anymore. So he comes in, I uninvent you, writing machine. And then I thought, okay, well, what's the problem? What would be the downside of having that inventor? The fact that you have a boxing elephant in the treehouse and it punches him in the nose could also be a problem, because then he goes, well, I uninvent that boxing elephant. And then you go, everything is potentially annoying. So he starts uninventing everything. And as we all know, there's plenty in the world to get annoyed about. So when would you stop uninventing things? So, yeah, it does follow a logic. But because I'm following it doggedly and literally, I'm not trying to be funny. I'm just trying to follow the logic. The humour is thrown off as a side effect of that, a secondary byproduct of following that thought to the illogical end. And I think that's where some people do get tripped up with humour. They try to make it funny, and there's almost a desperation. Oi, kids, oi, wacky, wacky. I don't do that. I'm like, I'm trying to write this book, and my stupid friend Terry has just left the door of the weather dome open, and now I've got weather, you know, hitting me, and this is bad. But we enjoy it because it's based on a silly premise.
It manages to take that, because I think, and using the example of kids in classrooms, that short form humorous writing is much more accessible for people, but taking short form and making it that full narrative, that sort of describes a way of doing that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I gradually learned from the short stories. There was about 70 of the Just short stories, and I was experimenting with different points of view and different ways of telling them. At one point in Just Disgusting, that was the fifth book in the series, I was by that stage I was established as a visiting author in schools. So I was going to a different school every day for three terms a year and running four sessions.
Oh my God. That's intense.
It was, and it was a great training ground too, because I could try the same joke four different ways in a day, and I'd go, the third way I did it was the best. And so I developed the skills of a stand-up comedian in that situation, because those kids often didn't want to be there. You know, you had to work to interest them. And I had a suitcase full of props, dinosaurs and babies and carrots and bizarre
real things. Babies.
Oh, no, well, no, maybe dolls. I was desperate one day. I'd been put in front of a group of grade twos. And I said, how long are we talking for? And he said, oh, it's about 90 minutes. So you got 90 minutes. I was like, that's a long time.
That's a long time.
By the end of the session, I was reduced to, oh, what have I got? I've got my Godzilla here. Hey, look at this Godzilla. Imagine if it met this tiny little baby doll on the street. What do you think would happen? And they'd go, the dinosaur's going to eat the baby. And I'd say, yes, okay, and we'd make that happen. And they'd laugh. And then I said, but what's more interesting? What if the baby ate the dinosaur? And they go, yeah, yeah. I say, how would, and then I go, logical, how would the baby kill the dinosaur? And I'd get them to think about the weapons that a baby might have, diapers being one of them, nappy pins, projectile vomit, whatever way. And it gets the dinosaur down. And then I just kept going because I had so long. I said, what if they became friends? You know, the baby rides on top of the dinosaur's back. Or what if it was the opposite? The dinosaur rides on the baby's back. And
oh, that's fantastic.
This is in microcosm how I would approach a plot, looking at all the possibilities and finally going, what if they fell in love? And they got married and they had children, and we could pull the head off this dinosaur and put the baby's head on the dinosaur's body, and they just broke the entire audience up.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Dinosaur on the baby's body. And then I'd say, okay, now the baby goes to school, it's got a dinosaur head. What do you think the other kids would say? They'd tease it. What would it do? It would bite the other kids, you know. So this process is endless, and it's really question asking. What if? What's the worst thing that could happen? And then what would logically ensue from that? And then what's your next problem? So I was going around the schools with my suitcase of toys, and that taught me a lot about what I would pitch stories to them, and I'd watch them whether they're interested or not. In this case, just disgusting, I said, okay, I've got a list of disgusting things that I'm going to write about in this book called Just Disgusting. I'm going to read them to you, and I want you to tell me what you think and whether I'm missing any. And so I'd read them the list, and it would be things like, let me see if I can remember, dog poo. And they go, dog poo. I go, yeah, that's pretty awful, isn't it? But probably even worse is number two on the list, standing in dog poo. And they go, standing in dog poo. And I say, and even worse, getting dog poo on your finger when you're trying to get it off the sole of your shoe with a stick. And then you got dog poo on your finger. And then I said, okay. And then so what I'm thinking is, what's even worse is later on you're eating a sausage roll and it tastes a bit like dog poo, and you realise that's because you forgot to wash your hands after the stick incident. And they were going, And then I came home to Jill, who's my wife and editor, and I said, they were just going off when I was reading this list. You know, maybe I don't even need a story here. If I just say 101 disgusting things and set myself the challenge of escalating it forever to the most disgusting thing at the end, there's a story without a conventional narrative. So it ebbs and flows, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever done, because you get to maybe 30 and then you think of something really disgusting and the previous 30 didn't seem that bad, so you had to go back again. But yeah, I did a number of those, and in fact the Treehouse series is based on lists. Every book I need 13 new levels, and I have, they can't repeat the levels that were in the previous books. They have to be new and different. So that's a creative discipline that I love, is forcing yourself to reach for what you don't even know is there, but you just know you need it.
So when you so this is like a brainstorming sort of technique. How long would the list be to come up with 13 stories?
I would estimate you probably go through 40 or 50 ideas that just keep getting rejected. Or, you know, they seem brilliant. And then you go, we can't do that because we had a very similar level, cake throwing level. We can't do that because we've already got a bun throwing level.
This gets harder and harder over time.
It does. And we're on book. I'm actually writing book number 13 at the moment, and it's becoming exponentially difficult. Although I've got 11 levels now, so I'm only looking for two. That's a process that does take months. And sometimes the story will demand it, a particular level. If I'm looking up 91 story, where we're minding the publisher's children, the grandchildren. And I said, well, what's the most dangerous thing if you were looking after children? A whirlpool, you know, the world's most dangerous whirlpool, because then they can fall in. So that kind of writes itself in reverse.
I'm interested. It's obviously a collaboration between you and Terry. You've done this for a long time together. Yep. How does it work? Which bits do you do together? Which bits do you do separately?
Well, in the beginning, in the Just series, Terry would just be in the margins. And I said, don't illustrate it conventionally. I want you to just do little flick pictures on the corners and just look like a bad kid in school who's not paying attention, just drawing all around the edge. And so that's what he did. And the page number became a strip cartoon with the page numbers talking to you the whole time. I hate being a page number. One, two, three. Oh, this is boring. And then other things would happen to it. So this was to encourage kids to play with the book and to see it as a comic book as much as short stories. But the more we went along, the more he was behind deadline once. He often leaves things quite late. Whereas to get for my logical creative process to work, I need plenty of time, and I generally get it done well ahead of a deadline. His creative juices fire on the deadline. And he rang me up and said, I've got 40 pages left to go and it's due in 2 days. And I said, do you want me? I'll come down and just make some suggestions. And we just had the best afternoon where I could just suggest any silly thing. You know, do the mouse that ran up the clock, you know, hickory dickory dock, mouse ran up the clock. But then when it gets to the top, just show it, instead of running down again, show it ripping the arms off and setting fire to it. That would be hilarious. And so that was the beginning of the collaboration, where we're in a room together feeding each other. And we eventually did that every 2 weeks. And that's how we did the bad book. That was written together in a room without any body particularly leading. We just go, everything's bad, so give me a bad drawing of something. And we go, oh, what about this? And pick a ridiculous donkey. And I go, oh, that's a shonky donkey. It's Pinky Ponky, the shonky wonky donkey. And so then I'd ask for more illustrations and it builds. So we would often sometimes go away for a week and just write and draw. That's how the first Treehouse book emerged from all our experimenting. These days, he is so in my head and I'm in his head so much, we don't need to be physically together very often, as it turns out, thanks pandemic. but we already know how we... The big thing I have with him is I don't have to do a lot of description. I can just say, check out our new 143-story treehouse. And then Terry draws it. The reader inhales it visually. Mm. So it allows the story to move more quickly and still be complex and interesting, but with very, very few words. So I think that's the essence of the collaboration with Jill as co-writer, editor, and sort of she'll tell me when it stopped being funny, if we're doing something repetitive. I'll take, really? I don't think 50 pages of Barky the barking dog just barking at the reader is funny. She goes, no, I think it's funny for about 2 pages. And I go, oh, no, please, please, 6? Can I have 6? And she goes, okay, you can have 6, but not 50. And that's crucial, because Terry and I can get very absurd, conceptual absurdism amuses us no end, but you've left the reader well behind. And I think what we always do, we do what we want to do, but with reference to a reader. And I think that's very important.
Andy, we get such a sense, and you've sort of touched on this, of you guys obviously in the Treehouse books, we get a sense of your relationship. Is it an accurate reflection, do you think? Are you that bossy?
Yes, but broadly. I mean, it's very broad and it's way exaggerated. I'm not really stomping around like some dictator. Do this, draw that, times, Terry, I'm so mad. But I would probably tend to be the project leader. I'm the one going, okay, we've got a book. We need to sit down. We need to do this. Terry, what are you drawing a picture of your finger for? How is that relevant? And you'll go, oh, it's just a picture of my finger. And I go, well, actually, maybe we could use that, you know, maybe in the book. Andy's trying to get something done and Terry draws a picture of his finger and then Andy gets mad and then says, oh, do I need to do my own pictures now? And then Terry challenges me, you can't draw. And yes, I can. And well, let's have a drawing contest. So we're now in fictional territory, but it starts with Terry's playful free association. And my job is to take that randomness and build it into a logical structure so that it looks like it was planned all along.
Andy, you described how you don't have to do as much description anymore. Terry's pictures bring sort of that visual to readers' minds. The Treehouse books are also audiobooks. My kids love them. They listen to them all the time. It seems really strange and counterintuitive that a book so heavy on pictures can work so well on audio. What did you guys think when that idea was first suggested?
Well, the narrator is Stig Weems, who has been narrating my books ever since Just Tricking. So he was well practiced at the type of humour and bringing it alive in an audio book way. So he does a lot of extraneous stuff that's often not in the text. He'll be introducing sound effects. He'll be running his own commentary. But he is, you know, an incredibly talented voice actor who brings it alive in the same way as Terry attends to the spirit of what I'm writing and brings that alive in pictures. Stig channels the chaos, and there's a sort of chaotic playfulness in the books. This is true of the stage plays too, which are 1 hour plays written by Richard Tulloch, who I know very well and is a longtime children's theatre expert. And so what he does is take the spirit of the books and compress it into 3 or 4 characters on stage for an hour. So it will diverge in certain ways, but I'll sit in on those production weeks and I'll just go, they're getting the spirit, you know, that's all I care about is does that playfulness come out? Yeah,
it feels a bit full circle. You started out in performance and it has come back to performance, or your work has come back to performance.
Oh, it's really exciting to see it in play form for a couple of reasons. One, because, I love live stuff, but also because it's the only way I can actually experience the work from the outside, because when you're inside the book, it's not necessarily... You know all your moves, so you're not surprised by it after the 15,000th reread and rewrite. It's all humming, but you're going, yeah, this is good, but it must be fun if you're coming to it fresh. And that's what I get with the plays, and I'm surrounded by kids and adults in the audience, so I can hear them reacting, and it actually helps me know what we're doing, and so I can do more of it. In each book.
Andy, you've had a lot of success as a writer. Presumably it hasn't always been smooth sailing. Do you have a favourite failure?
Ooh, favourite failure. let me see. It depends who you talk to. I have a favourite bad review.
Can you quote it verbatim?
Well, pretty much. The day my butt, you can go on Amazon.com and read it. The day my butt went psycho was something I did in Australia in 2001 to try to push the boundaries a little bit, because librarians were telling me that my books were being taken off the shelves because parents were complaining their kids were coming home with them. And I said, well, you know, maybe those kids, you should tell those kids not to take it home, but you can't tell all the kids in a whole school what they can and can't read. You need to stand up to them a bit. But there was a real timidity in schools, particularly. And so I said, right, I'm going to write a book called The Day My Bum Went Psycho. And it's going to be a ridiculous action thriller with bums. But the purpose is to get librarians, teachers, parents, booksellers saying the word bum over and over again. So we can just move on. And like, books don't have to be a play. They're not church. They're not Sunday school. We're not trying to teach a lesson. Although I did read recently the lesson of a book, the type I write, is that reading is really entertaining and you should do a lot of it. That's the serious purpose under it. So I wrote this book and then it came out, an American publisher saw it, Gene Fywell, publisher of Goosebumps, Babysitters Clubs and other amazing series. She said, I must have that book. And it came out and someone says on Amazon, I've never seen a book with so many 5-star reviews and so many 1-star reviews, because you either got it or you didn't. And the 1-star review said, I would have given it no stars, but I didn't have that option. I had to give it one. Too bad. If the works of Shakespeare could be typed by an infinite series of monkeys on an infinite number of typewriters, there over eternity, then this book could have been written by one monkey on one typewriter in a few short minutes.
Wow, that's comprehensive panning, isn't it?
That was fantastic. Another one said, I want to give it away, but I don't want any other child or adult agony reading it.
There is actually a creativity to some people's reviews, isn't it? I mean, if you can separate the hurt.
Well, I do. That book is something I've created for a specific purpose. It's not me. And I'm fascinated by the reactions that it then gets. And in most cases, sometimes they get it right and I am interested in what I'm not getting right. But in many cases, they're telling you about themselves more than what I like and what I think and what I can take. And so then it becomes a sort of just interesting feedback that doesn't have to crush you or hurt you. But, yeah, so listening to criticism and feedback is an art because they will get things right. And I have taken stuff from reviews and got that, you know, they had a point. I'm not going to do that anymore. So, the bad book, you know, there was a rhyme called Little Bad, what is it? Little something took a match and set fire to the cat, said, I can't remember the boy's name. He was a bad boy. Set fire to a cat, said little Willie as it burnt, I bet the cat hates that. And then he takes a match and sets fire to his knee and he says, ouch, that's hurting me. And then he takes a match and sets fire to his head, said little Willie as it burned, oh, soon I will be dead. Now, you know, ridiculous, absurd black humour. But the one everyone got upset about was the cat. And they said, you can't set fire to cats. And I said, well, I'm not encouraging anyone to do that. But they said, no, this is beyond the pale. And I realised what they were reacting to was the fact that he didn't suffer enough for doing this terrible act to a cat. Mm. He said, I bet the cat hates that, which is a psychopathic understatement. And so that's what I thought was obvious, but it wasn't. People going, that poor cat. So I reprinted and I took that rhyme out and said, Little Willie took a match and set fire to his bum. Said, as Little Willie, as it burnt, gee, that was pretty dumb. And then never any more complaints because the kid was setting fire to himself and he was suffering. And in the reader's morality, fair play. Yeah. If he's that dumb, let him do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. So that's sort of one of the invisible lines that you only find out through crossing. Mm.
Andy, I want to end on a positive note. What is the nicest thing a fan has ever done for you or your work?
Too many to count. I did have for a long time a young man. He lived in Newcastle, Corey, and he had the gift of knowing my books. Photographic memory, like you could literally pick up any of the Just books at a random page, read a sentence, and then he would just pick up and recite verbatim the entire book. It was really something. I wish I could do that. So he lived in those books. And he made me a little award once, which is a story about my best friend Danny pushing me around in a pram and then letting the pram go down a steep hill. And he made a little model of two little figurines pushing a pram and had it engraved to Andy, you know, the greatest author in the world. And, so that type of devotion and attention to what I write is, you know, it doesn't get better than that.
That's beautiful.
And that's repeated many, many times over with kids drawing their own tree houses and writing their own treehouse fan fiction, much of which I must say is as good or if not better than my own. So that's great because that's what I want to do. I just want to give the excitement that I felt when I was reading books as a kid and I loved reading them and I loved then responding and writing my own versions. I just wanted to pass that on to a new generation. So that's the biggest compliment you can pay me is to create something of your own. And then I go, great, that spirit of creativity and silliness is alive and it will be passed on. And because it's vital for our survival, vital for our mental health. And yeah, the silliness is very important.
I love that. We will end on the note of silliness is very important. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Andy.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.